greatest science, quaint as this science appears to us now when invoked by the earlier writers in this tradition. The patient didacticism is there from the beginning, the erudite exposure of the errors of religion, and of course, the triumphant scientism. Whether contemporary exponents would mention stones or rolled paper in discussing human motivation or memory, I doubt. But the case Russell makes for the non-existence of consciousness and the self is entirely up to date, if only in its conclusions. This might make him a man of foresight, a prophet, together with Hume and many others. Or it may simply mean that these premises and conclusions never change, however profoundly the science upon which they make their claims for authority transforms itself. I believe the selfish gene is now making its way toward the museum of discredited notions, to crowd the dusty case already occupied by assorted homunculi, the blonde beast, economic man, the evolutionary throwback, the dysgenic, the blank slate. Then what rough beast, its hour come round at last? No, it will be a beast whose claim to alarm are encouraged in the genteel environments in which it finds itself at home, a place always already prepared for it. When we had no better access to the brain as an object than by mapping the contours of the skull to gauge the relative proportions of the lobe of veneration and the lobe of amicability, when early Darwinism could interpret unfavored traits as evidence of evolutionary primitivity or atavism, when Freud could offer his sketch of a three-chambered brain that would neatly accommodate the three contending personae of the Freudian self, when the gene and its functions seemed mixed and straightforward, then it would have been relatively understandable to insist on a reductionist model of the human self, relatively understandable, that is, as opposed to its persistence in the present, despite the insight we have now into the endless complexity of everything from the subatomic to the intergalactic. The neurons and synapses in that brain are now reckoned in numbers that are literally astronomical. Elegant nature can hardly be imagined to have put such unfathomable complexity to such fundamentally simple work as these psychologies have posited for it. Edwards has a place in creation for things good in themselves. The spectacular brain would surely be one. But this is a theistic notion. In general, it is difficult to say what anything is without reference to what it does. We are surrounded on every side by the effects of the human brain on the material world, which are certainly as complex altogether as anything on earth after the biosphere. The arts, music, and philosophy are things of inexhaustible interest to human societies over centuries. Still, there are those who would account for all this brilliance and urgency as the effect of tiny increments of applied self-interest. And there are those who can be persuaded that this probably is the case. But the great truth, never taken into account, is that nothing is simple. Absolutely nothing. Mitosis in a cell seems to be about as complex as the 30 years' war, which is to say that complexity in both cases beggars description. There is absolutely no analog in reality as we now know it to support reductionism of the kind that offers a fundamental simplicity as the essential character of anything at all. Therefore, this immutable core belief, which survives and flourishes when science has moved far past the point where either ignorance or incomprehension could seem to sustain it, is interesting as an artifact. Why is it conserved? And why is it, as it has been since its emergence, a powerful presence in the world of ideas, an effective rebuke to all acknowledgement of the profundity of the human mind and circumstance? Edwards's synonym for a human being is a moral agent. Agent means, of course, that one can act. And moral implies that one's actions are meaningful in a social as well as a cosmic context. To me, this sounds like reality. His definition is, I think, empirically testable, at least in its worldly applications. Any newspaper could be entered in evidence. I have just begun his treatise, Freedom of the Will, which I had not looked at since college. My memory and his reputation lead me to expect him to deny that the will is free, though his thinking is always vastly more nuanced than his reputation. In any case, in the degree that his argument is determinist, a defense of an ancient and troublesome element of Christian doctrine, it compares interestingly with these modernist theories I have described. although they are often proposed as being more humane and rational than Christianity, often with special reference to the dread theological terms election and predestination, they are themselves so starkly determinist, so determinist in every iteration, that this is arguably their point. Then again, it could be true that the limits any sane person feels on his or her meaningful freedom are real and narrow enough to make at least a tentative argument for determinism. This would have been truer of the generality of people in any previous century, or again, the same tacit argument could be made by the accidents and injustices anyone must be aware of in the ordinary course of life. Be that as it may, it is interesting to note how consistently these theories diminish or dismiss the phenomenon of consciousness called the self, a given of experience, if there is such a thing in this world. This is true even when the governing motive behind all behavior, as they understand it, is self-interest, which seems to me to imply alertness to the interests of an entity that satisfies for their purposes the definition of a self. While on the one hand they might insist they intend a radically reduced and deromanticized entity, on the other hand, the interests of a self beyond the level of subsistence are highly circumstantial in particular, so the self can only be assumed to be complex. Likewise, whatever unnamed and undescribed mechanism it is that reckons its interest from one occasion to the next. I excuse phrenology on this point, since it did grant to the brain lobes devoted to a number of amiable traits. Interestingly, Russell allows for the possibility of freedom with reference to the human will. What this could mean in the absence of self or consciousness I cannot fathom, and he does not explain. But those who argue, as he does, are too confident of their thinking to check it for anomalies. For him, freedom is implied by quantum indeterminacy, reasonably enough. Elsewhere, he says, the belief that personality is mysterious and irreducible has no scientific warrant, and is accepted chiefly because it is flattering to our human self-esteem. If our being participates in something as mysterious and irreducible as quantum physics, and how could it not, the presumption ought to be on the side of extraordinary human complexity. If this elevates us in our own regard, well, sometimes the truth must be accepted, whatever its consequences. I hasten to add that we must assume we share this complexity with all being. Quantum doesn't play favorites. This might lead to a revival of that fine awe at the wonders of creation so characteristic of theology. To what extent is reputation a factor in our beliefs, opinions, and controversies, even the weightiest of them? I am interested in Edwards as a philosopher-theologian consciously working within the intellectual tradition of New England Puritanism. He is regularly described as the best philosophic mind this continent has produced, and no one knows anything about him except that he wrote a sermon about a spider. These two facts sit oddly together. Surely his status as a philosopher and man of letters should not be overwhelmed by a single sermon of a hortatory kind common in 18th century preaching. But it is. I am interested in American institutions and reforms that began in the Puritan Northeast. But, oddly enough, the states that banned and opposed slavery after the Revolution, as they could not do while they were colonies under British law, the states that advanced women's rights and achieved levels of literacy never before seen in the world, the states that practiced the purest form of democracy yet seen in the world, are thought of as peculiarly harsh and intolerant. This stigma, based solidly and immovably on ignorance of New England culture and of the world that was its context, ought not to overwhelm its crucial contributions to what is best in American culture. But it does. Somehow we are taught to sneer, and the sneer is a final and sufficient judgment on people and things of the highest interest and importance. It has been my eccentric fate to be attracted to subjects that have been excluded from the historical conversation by an aversion of which no account can be made, so deeply has the aversion itself obscured any knowledge of the matter in question. John Calvin is an instance, of course. Why not read the most influential theologian of the Protestant Reformation, who was also the most widely read writer in England during the English Renaissance, and a profound influence on American civilization, as they still say, providing no particulars, though the fact is taken to be regrettable on balance and to make our culture an object of aversion. Why not look at the Geneva Bible, Shakespeare's Bible, and Sidney's, Milton's, Spencer's, Bunyan's, which was out of print for hundreds of years, treated as a crude production, the so-called Breeches Bible of the Puritans, though the King James Version was a virtual reprint of it, minus the scholarly and interpretive notes, and with changes of translation that muted certain political implications. The King James Version appeared in 1611, at the end of Shakespeare's career, too late to have been known or used by him. The chronology is straightforward, and still it is almost impossible to make the case that Shakespeare was not mightily influenced by a text that did not yet exist. This notion has done almost as much to sanctify the volume as anything between its covers. The English civil wars of the 17th century were the first modern revolution, precursors of the American and French revolutions. The disorders that surrounded them set off a great migration to New England, a decisive influence on our national beginnings. Most educated Americans are unaware that there ever was a civil war in England, or a Commonwealth government there. The words Calvinist or Puritan are associated with each of the things I have named, and a strong negative energy attaches to those words. So with Edwards also, who tends to be treated as if damnation were his idea. The American Puritans were the most progressive population on earth through the 19th century at least. They deserve notice. All this is to prepare two points having to do with prejudices and their power, with fixed assumptions that distort our thinking gravely. First, in the old quarrel inexactly described as the conflict between science and religion, the side that associates itself with science is generally assumed to be the side of intellect and reason, as I have said. Second, the side of religion is therefore by implication a defense against both intellect and reason, a conservative nostalgia threatened by indubitable truths science has revealed to us. And these things can indeed be true of those who have undertaken religion's defense, sadly enough. In accepting this posture, they grant the major premise of their opposition and greatly strengthen its case. Russell, a looming figure in the early 20th century, was an influential advocate for what is called the scientific side. He writes about the conflict between religion and science, beginning in the Middle Ages, writing as if scientists and theologians were easy to distinguish in those days. After all, the system that put the earth at the center of the universe was no Romish invention, no projection of religious dogma, though he writes as if it were. It was the work of Ptolemy, a second-century pagan, and was the predominant scientific view of the heavens, defended by scientists as well as by churchmen, not only because theology had grown up around it, but also because with adjustments made over time, it worked uncannily well. One moral to be drawn from the episode is that religion should not involve itself too deeply, even with the most prestigious scientific thought, no matter how great the consensus that supports it. Russell makes much of certain remarkable theological doctrines of the time. Early sciences, alchemy, astrology, and medicine were bizarre as well, though I am aware of no mention of the motivations of stones and paper. In any case, I just read an article about a hypothesis that would account for the empty center of our solar system, anomalous compared with the many planetary systems that have now been observed. Jupiter and Saturn drifted inward toward the sun, ground up super-Earths and planetoids that would have made the system typical, then drifted back into remote space. I simplify, but elaboration would only make the tale more remarkable. If some far-sighted 15th-century Dominican had ventured this hypothesis, it would certainly have seemed preposterous to a man writing in 1935. However wrong the Middle Ages were in the particulars, they were right in not excluding the fantastical from their notions of the true. Russell used his learning in the science of his time opportunistically. As we can see now, when the appropriateness of analogies between human behavior and the ways of stones and paper is presumably rejected on all sides. While on the one hand, the errors of science are generally honorable things, detours on the way to better understanding, on the other hand, these notions of Russell's never had the slightest grounding in reality. The prestige of science derives from the assumption that it deals in truth, fact. This is its purpose and tendency, but at no point is the purpose assumed to be fully and finally achieved. Science is, after all, a strategy, a method, not a doctrine. This is the secret of its brilliance, its rigor, its general reliability. But reason is not strictly reason when it is leveraged against a faulty inference, that is, a bad guess. The list I made earlier of the various schools of thought, considered scientific in their time, that undertook to empty the heavens and enlighten humankind by oddly enough demonstrating to them that they had neither self nor soul, were a series of bad guesses, not one of them the foundation upon which truly rational or scientific thinking could be based. Some of them, notably racial science and eugenics, played out in atrocities. The question of the existence of God and all the rest is not affected in any way by the ineptitude of the case made against it. The prestige of science should not be affected by the fact that it is vulnerable to misuse. But certainly, historical perspective permits us to say that neither science nor reason, properly so called, was implicated in these earlier campaigns against religion. And again, a largely consistent position was maintained through all these shifts in rationalization. No God, no self. Religion could make the humanist case if its defenders were humanists. It could also make a rational and scientific case against scientism if it were not daunted by the old habit of deference, prejudice turned against itself. The selfish gene should have been laughed off the stage years ago, and it isn't gone yet. I personally don't believe that God would submit himself to proof. The very thought seems irreverent to me. I do enjoy the liberation of amazement that comes with seeing the world as the work of God, but that is another thing. On the same grounds, I have no interest in claims of disproof. As characteristic as the debunking of human inwardness is the smallness of the reality posited in this scientistic worldview. If physics and cosmology are truly sciences, then there exists a body of excellent evidence that the scale and the varieties of being vastly exceed anything an earlier generation could have imagined. This persuades me that reasoning about ultimate things cannot be based on the anomalous fragment of reality accessible to our awareness. The school of thought I speak of never leaves the little sphere of common sense, and indeed often adopts the rather condescending tone one takes in arguing from the stronghold of the merely obvious. I did mention Russell's allowing for the possibility of freedom on the basis of quantum indeterminacy, an appropriately tentative conclusion based on actual, empirically demonstrated science. Here is one of those prejudices I mentioned, the assumption that fact and reason lie always on one side of this old argument, even though over time the terms on which it has proceeded seem quaint at best, even bizarre. This prejudice seems to be held universally and to have shaped the conversation decisively. For the sake of reason and science, it would be an excellent thing to examine the degree to which either of them has actually figured in this controversy. Both of them are so central in this civilization that it is crucial to try to maintain some discipline in the understanding and use of them. In the meantime, I think the whole substance of the supposed controversy could be summarized as follows. Some people believe in God, and some people don't. Finally, that second prejudice, against humankind itself. It is striking and surely significant that denial of the reality of God is so consistently associated with a denial of attributes that historically are thought to be synonymous with human nature. The logic of this is not clear to me. Certainly the argument is made easier by the exclusion from consideration of things the species have done culturally, including, strangely enough, mathematics and science. Russell offers as fact the very familiar notion that humankind suffered a steep ontological demotion when the sun rather than the earth was accepted as the center of the solar system. If this argument was made by some religious authorities, cautioning against the influence of Copernicus and Galileo, there is no evidence I know of that this was in fact its effect. We are talking about the period called the Renaissance, after all, which launched the long experiment in expanding and celebrating human capacities that has been important, even definitive, in the history of the West. In any case, it is simply strange to imagine that the status of the human race by its own reckoning could depend on a map of the heavens. Putting aside ancient cosmologies, skill, beauty, brilliance, wisdom, as well as accretions of power and wealth were always seen and valued in and by human beings. Russell and others who repeat this canard seem to think that the religious authorities whom they otherwise disparage were right on this crucial point. They embrace this supposed consequence, the devaluing of humanity to the level their understanding of reality sees as appropriate. One might suppose that a writer who considers himself an advocate for science would see a triumph of human reason in the new cosmology that would support the rising humanism of the age. Instead, as is conventional, he sees the supposedly diminished human self-esteem that he takes to be consequent upon it as another newly revealed truth, that our self-esteem had been based on an error, a failure of understanding. This is an arbitrary decision, by no means inevitable or even logical, and therefore another indication of the importance to this school of thought of belief in a diminished humankind. Then, again conventionally, Russell says that the theory of evolution, by demonstrating that we are related to the animals, lowered human self-esteem. But this is a commonplace long before Charles Darwin. When Hamlet called man the paragon of animals, when Edwards says we are distinguished from the animals by our being endowed with understanding and moral sense, they are not saying anything new. The contention that has arisen about the particulars of the creation of Adam is not relevant to the question of our being, morphologically and biologically, animals. Edwards says, "Herein does very much consist that image of God wherein he made man, by which God distinguished man from the beasts, viz., in those faculties and principles of nature whereby he is capable of moral agency." Ordinary experience does suggest the legitimacy of this kind of distinction between humankind and the generality of creatures, putting aside every theory about how we came to be what we are. There are always self-professed Christians who can be roused to panic at anything remotely like an opportunity, who act as if the eternal body of Christ were under mortal threat because of some notion they find unlikable. They do much to affirm and encourage such notions. But the claim our kind make on our deep respect ought to be self-evident, together with our obligation to honor and value them. Why do religious people so often act as if respect for humankind were contingent on the interpretation of a few verses of Scripture? This tends very much to support the view that in fact human beings are not especially precious or remarkable. Does the phrase, "the image of God," not imply a reality that should be manifest to our experience as Christians? For that matter, can anyone at all who has lived in a family, a community, a civilization, doubt that they are indeed precious and remarkable? Yes, there are sociopaths. Exponents of the theories I have criticized are for the most part academics who can and do with every justification point out that they are probably nicer than I am. But they can point to nothing in their anthropology that defines goodness or that obliges us to act on any notion of it except, tacitly, one that is conventional in society at large. Now, a given of these theories is that the norms of society and religion are artificial and oppressive, contrary to our deepest impulses and our truest nature. Their essential value is at best relativized. This is one consequence of the jettisoning of metaphysics. Edwards's thought is loyal to a tradition that does not believe our works in this life can merit any reward in heaven. Instead, he sees whatever is good or gracious or beautiful in any human act or thought as an emanation of the divine beauty, sacredness itself. A vision like his would make any other person potentially, or in any moment actually, a revelation of the nature of God, as the brilliance of creation is also. I find this a wonderful understanding of the highest human capacities for generosity and love, equally with intelligence and aesthetic sense. The last of these, in Edwards's scheme, the means of our individual participation in a revelation that saturates experience, since being itself is an emanation of God. Other traditions articulate the felt value, even the holiness, of the highest human traits in other terms, but always with reference to eternity. These virtues endure beyond mortal life, and are honored here and hereafter as a faithful anticipation of an ultimate reality. In the infinitely smaller conceptual world allowed to human existence when metaphysics is disallowed, there is no language to describe human conduct in moral terms. There is one account to be made, for generosity as for theft, for honor equally with shamelessness. Every act is at root simply a strategy of self-interest. If this is not an inevitable consequence of the exclusion of metaphysics, if it is not true necessarily that this should be arrived at as an unchangeable tenet, it is true, in fact, a consistent assumption of these theories, phrenology again excluded. Exponents of these theories consider themselves to be loyal to truth and reason at whatever cost to traditional beliefs and preferences. Truth and reason are estimable values, certainly. But is it true or rational to adhere to any one of the previous avatars of this theory? If not, then a burden falls on any subsequent version of it to prove that it amounts to more than a posture, an acculturated role or habit. Who can show me a shred of empirical evidence for the existence of anything resembling a selfish gene? The prejudice that allows these theories to claim the authority of reason and science is, among many other things, a slander on reason and science. What will replace them? It never hurts to take a new look at things. I would be happy to recover respect for the aesthetic sense that allows human beings to act graciously and beautifully, and to be honored for their capacity to enact fine behaviors under the demands of, or in light of, the opportunities of endlessly new occasions. Let us face the truth that human beings are astonishing creatures. Each life so singular in its composition, and so deeply akin to others, that they are inexhaustibly the subject of every art. A tremendous freedom always lies behind prejudice, and begins to be released the moment the errors that are the substance of prejudice are acknowledged as error. Our present world does not need to be offered cynicism as ultimate truth. It does not need new grounds for indifference to human life, or contempt for the norms that discourage exploitation and violence. The Divine. The William Belden Noble Lecture at Harvard Memorial Church, April 4, 2016. When words drop out of use, meanings go with them, perhaps. When the sense of the significant changes, language changes, or so it seems, it has been characteristic of the modern West for generations to try to move away from a vocabulary that is charged with its own intellectual and cultural history, the shift being understood as advancing thought from the pre-scientific to the scientific, or from the religious to the secular, these two motives being more or less interchangeable. There is nothing especially novel in this. Quakers noticed that the days and months were named for pagan gods and dignitaries, and so they numbered them instead, first day, second day. The French Revolution reset the calendar to year one and renamed the months Germinal, Floréal, but the pretty new names could not be made to adhere, or the Quaker numbers either. So Janus still stands at the opening of the year, Mars still brings his tempests, the emperors Julius and Augustus still lord it through our high summer. Sun and Moon, Woden, Thor, and Saturn still name our days. Language changes, and language conserves itself. We human beings are the language makers, of course, but efforts like these to change it respond to an awareness that in very important ways language creates us. At best, we try to suppress demeaning words because they are powerful. They affect the ways in which people are perceived, and also their perceptions of themselves. We are seeing now that there are those who react to the use of such words as an assertion of power, something to be admired, something to be reclaimed. In other words, while a slur has no intrinsic meaning, think of the thousands of slurs coined for and by the hundreds of ethnic groups that make up this country, its power lies in the fact that where it is used, an individual will not be considered in his or her own right, that the traits attributed to a disfavored group will be applied to her, dismissing out of hand her claims to respect, her circumstances, her achievements, which are in any case seem to be compromised by race or gender. It seems that we have, in this country at this time, an experience of disempowerment in a significant part of the population, and that the old despotisms of disparagement and abuse are reasserting their claims because they have retained the power of old injustices, no matter how far society may have moved in a better direction. The schoolyard wisdom is wrong. Words can be very like sticks and stones, crude weapons that are always ready to hand. The use of them requires no skill at all. I mention this to make the point that, as present experience illustrates with painful clarity, we are profoundly enmeshed in language. Slurs have their power because we all acknowledge the kind of meaning they have and the very fact of our recoiling from their use, so they live on. What has crude, assaultive language to do with the odd assortment of pagans and pagan deities whose names, after millennia, haunt our calendar? What have either of these to do with the fact that there are words and concepts that do indeed fade out of use, despite the fact that we might sometimes feel the lack of them? Language is a universe. Its elements are truly various, given, to use a favorite word of mine. They act eccentrically in time. They elude generalization. I have been thinking about the phrase, the divine. I cannot remember the last time I heard it in the context of religion. It is not synonymous with the sacred or the holy, certainly not with the spiritual. It is different from all these in that it refers directly to God, or in the Latin of pagan antiquity, to a god. If we suppose that it has become rare because our vision of ultimate reality no longer centers on a divine being, this is an epochal change, certainly. We in the West tend to imagine that changes in our thinking are advances of some kind, or are at least made inevitable in consequence of cultural or material evolution. In the most horrifying period of recent Western history, when Europe might well have been entering a new dark age, Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote that his was a world come of age, which must be offered a religionless Christianity. I take him to have meant, or at least to have been exploring the idea, that for Christianity to survive in modern culture, it must be relieved of its burden of ritual and myth. Bonhoeffer was a brilliant writer and an exemplary man. But it is difficult to understand how he could have seen collective maturity in a civilization then giving itself over to the myths and cults of an imagined primitivity and to the active rehabilitation of Norse barbarism. In any case, this interpretation of modern culture as qualitatively changed by a new maturity outlasted the bizarre mutations that might seem to have challenged it, and will outlast them again, no doubt, since we have no reason at all to assume that they will not reemerge in one form or another, or are not reemerging now. If the West has an enduring faith in any one idea, it is that the West advances. That is to say, that it matures in the direction of enlightenment, with all this entails in terms of the loss of illusion and the rejection of error. We stigmatize what we feel we must reject, and this discourages a reappraisal. As we do this, we build the thinking of an earlier period into our understanding of the world, when by the logic of our assumptions, we should be as scrupulously aware of the potential for error in conclusions drawn 50 or 100 years ago as of those drawn 1,000 years ago. The errors of the long modern period might seem subtler to our eye than those of earlier centuries, but there is no reason to assume that they are less consequential. What is myth, after all? It is narrative that conveys a kind of truth by non-literal means. This is a definition meant to exclude the influence of a common second sense of the word, that a myth is unreal, untrue. Setting this aside for the moment, I will suggest that the primary meaning of the word myth, as it has been applied to Christianity, would be those elements of the religion that it has in common with other religions. The ascendant West was ill at ease with the resemblance of its religion to non-Western religions. In its likeness to them, Christianity must be primitive. Therefore, these elements were to be eliminated to conform Christianity to the worldview of a mature civilization. If myth or mythos were really thought of as a higher, more complex articulation of truth that is in principle available to being restated in other terms, then there is nothing about it to embarrass or offend the rational mind. If it is the truth it proposes that is rejected, this is another issue entirely, in which myth as such is not implicated. Rather, the religion itself is tacitly called into question. The divine, divinitas, is a concept for which pagan Rome has a word Christianity could adopt without modification. To speak of the divinity of Christ as always meant not that he was a sacred or holy or spiritual man, though these things were true of him, but that he uniquely participated in the nature of God altogether, that he was God, and that he is God, since this is not the kind of statement that admits of a true past tense. The Incarnation, the Trinity, these are names for things in which divinity as Christianity has long understood it is expressed and very tentatively described. It should not scandalize us people of the third millennium when language that reaches toward the essentially true departs from the standards of comprehensibility we would apply to experience, acknowledging, of course, that our experience is a brilliant translation of the infinite and volatile complexities of being itself into a world and universe that, remarkably or providentially, seems to lie within our grasp. Science before the 20th century supported the assumption that reason was, as the physicists say, flat, that like the laws of nature, its rules were the same everywhere and in all circumstances, and that whatever they could not countenance was an error, a primitive survival, a mystification. Then along came quantum physics, relativity, a theory of cosmic origins, and science ever since has been continuously at work at a new poetry, trying to capture something of the startling elegance, novel to our eyes, that eventuates in everything that is. Crucially assisted by dark matter, of course, which seems to hold the heavens together, and about which little else can at present be said. Only grant that a great creating holiness is at the center of it all, and one must arrive at something like the extraordinary language in which the ancients invested their perceptions. For the ancients, the great creative holiness was the intuition, the conception, that forced their language so far beyond the limits of the commonplace. Science departed from its origins in religion not so very long ago. If these two great thought systems are not now once again reaching a place of convergence, the fault lies with religion, which in a fit of defensive panic has abandoned its profoundest insights and has never reclaimed them. In the book of Acts, Paul, speaking to the Athenians, quotes one of their own poets, perhaps Epimenides, in invoking the God in whom we live and move and have our being. He recognized that behind all the idolatry, there was a metaphysics. Christianity, as it spread into the world, seems to have assumed this. It adopts the generic word for God in the pagan languages, Deus in Latin, God or Gott in Germanic Northern Europe. Whatever error might be liable to come with the use of a word associated for many centuries with Venus or Neptune, Thor or Woden, this did not weigh against a consensus about the reality of the divine across these very different cultures. There is a precedent for this in the Bible itself. The first verse of Genesis reads, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." The word God translates very precisely the Hebrew Elohim, a plural form of a generic word for God or gods, angels or powers, in the Semitic languages of the ancient Near East. The name given to Moses at the burning bush, the Tetragrammaton, modifies Elohim in the second creation narrative, but in the first, the word appears without a modifier. A respectful reading might see this as reflecting an understanding of the emergence of being as the act of a divine power whose reality is a human intuition as broadly shared as the affinity of languages will allow the text to express. El is the name of the god at the head of the Canaanite pantheon. The god of the Bible is called El in some poetic contexts. Many scholars see this as evidence of syncretism, or of a polytheism lurking behind the declared monotheism of the Hebrew Bible. But the analogy to our own use of the word God should suggest otherwise. The controversy between science and religion comes down to a familiar question. Is there a God? That is there an intentional power expressed in the existence of things? If the character of this power were to be modified by the name and the traditions surrounding any particular deity, this would not change either the question or the answer, nor would the metaphysical implications of the answer be fundamentally different either way. If Babylonian Marduk is at the center of being, heavens and earth are to be thought of as made from the corpse of a great serpent, and humankind is an afterthought, tolerated for its usefulness in building temples and offering sacrifices. If the god the scholars call Yahweh is at the center, his creation is good, Humankind bears his image and is the object of his deep attention and his care. These are great differences with profound implications, yet secondary in significance, to that more basic question, whether there is a God, whether reality in itself is or is not of a kind to require an affirmative answer. I do not mean to imply that any sufficient proof can ever be adduced on one side or the other of the question, only that one or the other must be true and must always have been true. Many of the religious among us have abandoned the divine as a concept, attempting to find a compromise position, which in the nature of the case doesn't exist. Anthropologists can speak as fluently as theologians of the sacred or the holy or the spiritual, taking them to be an artifact of culture, if nothing else. For these scholars, patterns of behavior are sufficient proof that the terms are appropriate. The divine, by comparison, is a phrase that asserts the existence of a god or gods, that is, of a mode of being not conjured from human fear or hope, but prior to and independent of humankind, and profoundly efficacious, to be understood by tentative analogy to human consciousness, which it utterly transcends. The divine is understood to confer sanctity. It is acknowledged in the authority of the sacred, but cannot be, so to speak, captured by it. All the temples to Zeus and all the statues of him were not to be taken for Zeus himself. Say that this understanding of the divine was very broadly shared in the ancient world. Are these grounds for treating it as myth in any invidious sense? The modern West passed through its period of triumphalism, which has not ended yet, relegating all that was not modern or Western to the status of error, however pretty or interesting it might be in particular instances. Through most of this period, till well into the 20th century, science rejected what much of antiquity knew, which is that the universe had a beginning. The Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Greeks in Hesiod's Theogony, and the ancient Hebrews each tell the tale very differently, which suggests that it arose not from mutual influence, but from the independent intuition of an original act or moment, somehow still palpable, after the billions of years that had already passed before the ancients began their speculations. These ancestors are not at all remote from us in cosmic time, of course, and the physical world we see, if we wander a little distance from its pavements and enclosures, is for all purposes the same world. We reasoned ourselves away from the perception of it as emergent at the same time that we began to think of our own ancient text as mythic in a pejorative sense. Our best minds knew less about reality than Moses would have told them. This tendency toward dismissiveness persists. It seized the rhetorical high ground perhaps 200 years ago and has never relinquished it. The anxiety it inspires in some quarters has yielded a literalism that is brutally disrespectful of the text. Among non-literalists, it has produced an evasiveness that shies away from the text and from theological tradition as well. In many cases, what is intended as resistance to literalism tacitly concedes the legitimacy of literalism because sophisticated assumptions about the ancient and the mythic make reductionist readings seem inevitable. The new atheists, claiming the authority of science, go on about the old man with a white beard seated on a cloud, or they chuckle and scold at the thought of an imaginary friend. The response among the pious has been in some cases to put Adam on a dinosaur, proposing a science of their own. There is little to choose between the two. In both cases, there is a radical rejection of the language of the sublime, that is, of the divine. In neither case is there any conception of the beautiful. Say what one will about religion through the millennia, it has yielded a great bounty of art in every kind. When King Solomon set about building the great temple in Jerusalem, where the Lord would put his name, he brought in foreign craftsmen who built something very like the temples of their own gods. Presumably, to the eye of Solomon and all Israel, in its sacred architecture, pagan culture could and did evoke holiness and sublimity of a kind appropriate to the temple of the God of Israel. This is the kind of thing that is regularly seen as evidence of syncretism and interpreted as evidence that the whole of the religion of Israel came together piecemeal from surrounding influences. There is an impulse to debunk in academic writing that is so long established as to be unconscious in many instances. The impulse is only more persistent because it is now taken to be the tone and substance of disinterested scholarship, a correction against the biases of traditional piety that need not concern itself with biases of its own. And the fact is that Israel lived in a swarming world surrounded by cultural kindred absorbed in their own rituals and myths. They lived in history, like any other people. But every argument for syncretism can also be taken as evidence that Israel saw a true sense of the sacred in the surrounding cultures, not in the particulars of their beliefs and practices, but in the more primary fact that they had an intuition of the divine that did indeed bear some analogy to Israel's. In his letter to the Romans, Paul says this about pagans and their religions. What can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man or birds or animals or reptiles. Chapter 1, verses 19 to 23. God has shown himself to mankind plainly in his creation. The pagans know God, but their knowledge of him is warped and distracted by idolatry, worship of the creature rather than the creator. So the main point is established clearly here, that behind all the passionate differences and all the polemics, there is, in however fragmentary a form, a shared and true perception of the divine. Time forbids the citing of numerous texts to the same effect to be found in the Hebrew Bible, a natural consequence of its monotheism. The Athenians ask Paul to tell them something new, and he responds by telling them something timeless. He says, God himself gives to all men life and breath and everything. And he quotes from another Greek poet, Aratus, who says of God, For we are indeed his offspring. Seen in this light, the similarities between Israelite and other religions should seem unembarrassed, a recognition and acknowledgement, not proof of cultural or textual pilfering. Above all, there should be no disparagement of implied claims of the religion of Abraham and Moses to immediate and original knowledge of God, when all knowledge of God, insofar as it retains some character of truth, must be immediate and original. God has shown it to humankind in the things that have been made. Let us say that there are grounds for speaking of the divine as mythic. It structures and characterizes reality in the way of myth. It asserts the existence of a being or beings aloof from time who bear some likeness to humankind. It implants concepts like virtue and transgression so deeply in reality that reality responds to them as part of its own fabric. It is like myth in that it has scale. It refers to duration no human will ever experience. It refers to eternity, thinking past the extreme finitude of birth and death. And it considers the heavens. God only knows what night looked like when the last lamp went out in Babylon or Jerusalem, or in Calvin's mountainous Geneva, and the great host of stars, innumerable as the sands of the sea, claimed its place in the firmament. On the one hand, since Galileo, people have worked with passionate diligence to understand and observe the heavens, and what a sight they are. We have looked into Melvillian nurseries and glimpsed the births of stars that came into being many millions of years ago, an odd privilege of our relation to space and time. We do these things that are the unimaginable realizations of antiquity's old longing, and there is scarcely a poem or a prayer by way of celebration. It moves us not. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan. That is Wordsworth, of course, who need not have wished for more than to be a Christian or a Jew in a place and time where the revelatory character of creation was acknowledged. But he is right, all in all. It is the absence of divinity that dehumanizes nature. There is nothing paradoxical in this thought. Myth brings scale to the narratives that stir the human imagination. Old Marduk, whose loss to the pantheon is not particularly to be lamented, did make one pleasing proof of his standing among the gods of Babylon, who did not at first accept his claims to supremacy. He flung a constellation into being, then made it vanish, then restored it. He did other things less beautiful, which nevertheless yielded the Tigris and the Euphrates heaven and earth. The heavens for most of us now are a kind of wearying, ethereal sea that accommodates travel from one coast or continent to another, its vastness and even its turbulence largely forgettable with good earphones and a movie. Or it is the dumping ground, so to speak, of far more detritus than even its great volume can dilute. We keep an eye on it now to gauge its health, speculating nothing, concluding nothing about humankind from our epic power to decreate. Properly speaking, we are the stuff of myth, and yet we have no language to address the scale of the experience we have, not only as dwellers in a cosmos, but also as creatures whose thoughts naturally inhabit the vastnesses of myth, creation to doomsday, who see our galaxy as a path across the heavens, who spin new tales of the impossible even while we sleep. A splendid dignity is spread out over all this, whether recognized or not, by the divine, the good and glorious creator and center and substance of it all. The American Scholar Now. Presidential Lecture at Stanford University, October 29, 2015. Published in Harper's Magazine as Save Our Public Universities, March 2016. Emerson's lecture, The American Scholar, which he delivered in 1837, implicitly raises radical questions about the nature of education, culture, and consciousness, and about their interactions. He is urging his hearers to make the new world as new as it ought to be, urging his audience to outlive the constraints colonial experience imposed on them, and to create the culture that would arise from the full and honest use of their own intellects, minds, and senses. Any speaker might say the same to any audience. Every generation is in effect colonized by its assumptions and also by the things it reveres. The future, in the American experience, has always implied an inevitable departure from the familiar together with the possibility of shaping inevitable change. The historical circumstance of the country at the time Emerson spoke made vivid what is always true, that there is a frontier, temporal rather than geographical, which can and surely will be the new theater of old crimes and errors, but which can and will be an enlargement of experience, a region of indeterminacy, of possibility. The difference between any decade and the next makes this point. In his introduction to Democracy in America, Alexis de Tocqueville says a very striking thing about the world then unfolding. From the moment when the exercise of intelligence had become a source of strength and wealth, each step in the development of science, each new area of knowledge, each fresh idea had to be viewed as a seed of power placed within people's grasp. Poetry, eloquence, memory, the beauty of wit, the fires of imagination, the depth of thought, all these gifts which heaven shares out by chance turn to the advantage of democracy, and even when they belong to the enemies of democracy, they still promoted its cause by highlighting the natural grandeur of man. Its victories spread, therefore, alongside those of civilization and education. Tocqueville, like Emerson, stood at a cusp of history where literacy and democracy were both assuming an unprecedented importance in the civilization of the West. Not unambivalent in his feelings about democracy, Tocqueville did see it as based on the natural grandeur of man brought to light by education. Poetry, eloquence, memory, the beauty of wit, the fires of imagination, the depth of thought. These things are mentioned as rarely now as the object or effect of education, as the natural grandeur of man is mentioned as an assumption of our culture or a basis of our politics. Emerson delivered his address to the Phi Beta Kappa Society after the publication of Tocqueville's first volume and before the publication of the second. He was speaking at a time when colleges were being founded all across America, my own university, Iowa, in 1847. The great Frederick Law Olmsted was at that time putting his aesthetic blessing on our public spaces, notably on college campuses, including finally Stanford. The Oxford English Dictionary defines campus as an Americanism. The conventions established in the early 19th century have persisted in meadows and gardens and ponds that celebrate, if only out of habit, these cities of the young, these local capitals of learning and promise. Olmsted, like Emerson, would have seen something like the emergence of brilliant individuality in unexpected places that Tocqueville describes. Strongly potential in American life, though as yet suppressed, according to Emerson, by a preoccupation with the practical, with trade and enterprise, and suppressed as well by a colonial deference toward the culture of Europe. Like Tocqueville, Emerson is proposing an anthropology, proposing that there is a splendor inherent in human beings that is thwarted and hidden by deprivation of the means to express it, even to realize it in oneself. The celebration of learning made visible in its spread into the territories and the new-made states must have taken some part of its character from the revelation of human gifts it brought with it. It is interesting to see what persists over time, and interesting to see what is lost. For those to whom Emerson is speaking, who have made a good account of themselves as students at Harvard, deprivation is the effect of an unconscious surrender, a failure to aspire, to find in oneself the grandeur that could make the world new. We know these people. In fact, we are these people, proudly sufficient to expectations, our own and others, and not much inclined to wonder whether these expectations are not, in fact, rather low. We have, of course, accustomed ourselves to a new anthropology that is far too sere to accommodate anything like grandeur, and which barely acknowledges wit in the 19th century or the modern sense. Eloquence might be obfuscation, since the main project of the self is now taken by many specialists in the field to be the concealment of selfish motives. How do we define imagination these days, and do we still associate it with fires? Unless it is escape or delusion, it seems to have little relevance to the needs of the organism for good or ill. So, like character, like the self, it is no doubt by now defined out of existence. We leave it to a cadre of specialists to describe human nature, a phrase that, by their account, no doubt names yet another non-existent thing. It must be said that at best these specialists would show no fondness for it if they did concede its existence, nor do they allow to it any of the traits it long found ingratiating in itself. This is so true that the elimination of the pleasing, the poignant, the tragic from our self-conception, I will not mention brilliance or grandeur, would seem to be the object of the exercise. Plume-plucked humankind. Tocqueville and Emerson might be surprised to find us in such a state, after generations of great freedom, by the standards of history, and after the vast elaboration of resources for learning in every field. In fact, it is this vast elaboration, epitomized in the American university, that proves we have had a loftier view of ourselves historically, and it is a demonstration of the change in our self-conception that our universities, as they exist, no longer make sense to legislatures and to people of influence, a phrase that, in our moment, really does mean moneyed interests. Traditional centers of influence, churches, unions, relevant professionals, have lost their place in public life, or they have merged their influence with the moneyed interests, speaking here of those churches that do maintain a public presence. From this perspective, the great public universities, and many of them are very great, are like beached vessels of unknown origin and intention, decked out preposterously with relics and treasures, ripe for looting insofar as what they hold would find a market, condemned to neglect and decay insofar as the cash value of what they hold is not obvious to the most astringent calculation. There has been a fundamental shift in American consciousness. The citizen has become the taxpayer. In consequence of this shift, public assets are now public burdens. These personae, citizen and taxpayer, are both the creations of political rhetoric. It now requires an unusual degree of historical awareness to know that both politics and rhetoric were once honorable things. An important aspect of human circumstance is that we can create effective reality simply by consenting to the reality of the phantasms of the moment or the decade. While the citizen can entertain aspirations for the society as a whole and take pride in its achievements, the taxpayer, as presently imagined, simply does not want to pay taxes. The societal consequences of this aversion